but the genes of his mate would dilute the intelligence, so the puppies would be smart, but not as smart as their father. And each succeeding generation would get dimmer, duller, until eventually his great-great-great-grandpups would just be ordinary dogs. What's the third possibility? Intelligence, being a survival trait, might be genetically dominant, very dominant. In which case his puppies would be as smart as he is. And their puppies after them, on and on, until in time you'd have a colony of intelligent golden retrievers, thousands of them all over the world. They were silent again. Finally, she said, "Wow." Travis said, "He's right."
"What?"
"It is something worth thinking about." Part 4. Vince Nasco had never anticipated back in November that he would need a full month to get a whack at Ramon Velasquez, the guy in Oakland who was a thorn in the side of Don Mario Tatracna. Until he wasted Velasquez, Vince would not be given the names of people in San Francisco who dealt in false ID and who might help him track down Travis Cornell, the woman, and the dog. So he had an urgent need to reduce Velasquez to a hunk of putrefying meat. But Velasquez was a goddamn shadow. The man did not make a step without two bodyguards at his side, which should have made him more rather than less conspicuous. However, he conducted his gambling and drug enterprises, infringing on the Tatragna franchise in Oakland with all the stealth of Howard Hughes. He slipped and slithered on his errands, using a fleet of different cars, never taking the same route 2 days in a row, never meeting in the same place, using the street as an office, never staying anywhere long enough to be made, marked, and wiped out. He was a hopeless paranoid who believed everyone was out to get him. Vince couldn't keep the man in sight long enough to match him with the photograph that the Tatragnas had supplied. Ramon Velasquez was smoke. Vince didn't get him until Christmas Day, and it was a hell of a mess when it went down. Ramon was at home with a lot of relatives. Vince came at the Velasquez property from the house behind it, over the high brick wall between one big lot and the other. Coming down on the other side, he saw Velasquez and some people at a barbecue on the patio near the pool, where they were roasting an enormous turkey. Did people barbecue turkeys anywhere but in California? And they all spotted him immediately, though he was half an acre away. He saw the bodyguards reaching for weapons in their shoulder holsters, so he had no choice but to fire indiscriminately with his Uzi, spraying the entire patio area, taking out Velasquez, both bodyguards, a middle-aged woman who must have been somebody's wife, and an old dame who had to be somebody's grandmother. Snap, 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 snap. Everyone else, inside and outside of the house, was screaming and diving for cover. Vince had to climb the wall back into the yard of the house next door, where nobody was home, thank God, as he was hauling his ass over the top. A bunch of Latino types at the Velasquez place opened fire on him. He barely got away with his hide intact. The day after Christmas, when he showed up at a San Francisco restaurant owned by Don Tatragna to meet with Frank DiCinciano, a trusted family capo who answered only to the Don himself, Vince was worried. The Fratellanza had a code about assassinations. Hell, they had a code about everything, probably even bowel movements. And they took their code seriously. But the code of assassination was maybe taken a little more seriously than others. The first rule of that code was, you don't hit a man in the company of his family unless he's gone to ground and you just can't reach him any other way. Vince felt fairly safe on that score. But another rule was that you never shot a man's wife or kids or his grandmother in order to get at him. Any hit man who did such a thing would probably wind up dead himself, wasted by the very people who had hired him. Vince hoped to convince Frank DiCinciano that Velasquez was a special case. No other target had ever eluded Vince for a month, and that what had happened in Oakland on Christmas Day was regrettable but unavoidable. Just in case DiCinciano, and by extension the Don, was too furious to listen to reason, Vince went prepared with more than a gun. He knew that if they wanted him dead, they would crowd him and take the gun away from him before he could use it, as soon as he walked into the restaurant and before he knew the score. So he wired himself with plastic explosives and was prepared to detonate them, wiping out the entire restaurant if they tried to fit him for a coffin. Vince was not sure if he would survive the explosion. He had absorbed the life energies of so many people recently that he thought he must be getting close to the immortality he had been seeking, or was already there. But he could not know how strong he was until he put himself to the test. If his choice was standing at the heart of an explosion, or letting a couple of wise guys pump 100 rounds into him and encase him in concrete for a dunk in the bay, he decided the former was more appealing, and perhaps offered him a marginally better chance of survival. To his surprise, DiCenziano, who resembled a squirrel with meatballs in his cheeks, was delighted with how the Velazquez contract had been fulfilled. He said the Don had the highest praise for Vince. No one searched Vince when he entered the restaurant. At a corner booth, as the first men in the room, he and Frank were served a special lunch of dishes not on the menu. They drank $300 Cabernet Sauvignon, a gift from Mario Tatragna. When Vince cautiously raised the issue of the dead wife and grandmother, DiCenziano said, "Listen, my friend, we knew this was going to be a hard hit, a demanding job, and the rules might have to be broken. Besides, these people were not our kind of people. They were just a bunch of wetback spicks. They don't belong in this business. If they want to try to force their way into it, they can't expect us to play by the rules." Relieved, Vince went to the men's room halfway through lunch and disconnected the detonator. He didn't want to set the plastique off accidentally now that the crisis was past. At the end of lunch, Frank gave Vince the list. 9 names. "These people, who are not all family people, by the way, pay the Don for the right to operate their ID businesses in his territory. Back in November, in anticipation of your success with Velazquez, I spoke to these 9, and they'll remember that the Don wants them to cooperate with you in any way they can." Vince set out the same afternoon, looking for someone who would remember Travis Cornell. Initially, he was frustrated. 2 of the first 4 people on the list could not be reached. They had closed up shop and gone away for the holidays. To Vince, it seemed wrong that the criminal underworld would take off for Christmas and New Year's as if they were school teachers. But the 5th man, Anson Van Dyne, was at work in the basement beneath his topless club. Hot tips. And at 5:30, December 26th, Vince found what he was after. Van Dyne looked at the photograph of Travis Cornell, which Vince had obtained from the back-issue files of the Santa Barbara newspaper. "Yeah, I remember him. He's not one you forget. Not a foreigner looking to become an instant American like half my customers. And not the usual sad-ass loser who needs to change his name and hide his face. He's not a big guy, and he doesn't come on tough or anything. But you get the feeling he could mop up the floor with anyone who crossed him. Very self-contained. Very watchful. I couldn't forget him." "What you couldn't forget," said one of the 2 bearded boy wonders at the computers, "is that gorgeous quiff he was with. For her, even a dead man could get it up," the other one said. The first said, "Yeah, even a dead man. Cake and pie." Vince was both offended and confused by their contributions to the conversation, so he ignored them. To Van Dyne, he said, "Is there any chance you'd remember the new names you gave them?" "Sure, we got it on file," Van Dyne said. Vince could not believe what he had heard. "I thought people in your line of work didn't keep records. Safer for you and essential for your clients." Van Dyne shrugged. "Fuck the clients. Maybe one day the feds or the locals hit us, put us out of business. Maybe I find myself needing a steady flow of cash for lawyers' fees. What better than to have a list of a couple of 1,000 bozos living under phony names? Bozos who'd be willing to be squeezed a little rather than to start all over again with new lives." "Blackmail," Vince said. "An ugly word," Van Dyne said. "But apt, I'm afraid. Anyway, all we care about is that we are safe, and that there aren't any records here to incriminate us. We don't keep the data in this dump. As soon as we provide someone with a new ID, we transmit the record of it over a safe phone line from the computer here to a computer we keep elsewhere. That way that computer is programmed. The data can't be pulled out of it from here. It's a one-way road. So if we're busted, the police hackers can't reach our records from these machines. Hell, they won't even know the records exist." This new high-tech criminal world made Vince woozy. Even the Don, a man of infinite criminal cleverness, had thought these people kept no records and had not realized how computers had made it safe to do so. Vince thought about what Van Dyne had told him, getting it all sorted out in his mind. He said, So can you take me to this other computer and look up Cornell's new ID? For a friend of Don Tetragna's, Van Dyne said. I'll do just about anything but slit my own throat. Come with me. Van Dyne drove Vince to a busy Chinese restaurant in Chinatown. The place must have seated 150, and every table was occupied, mostly by Anglos rather than Asians. Although the joint was enormous and was decorated with paper lanterns, dragon murals, imitation rosewood screens, and strings of brass wind chimes in the shapes of Chinese ideograms, it reminded Vince of the kitschy Italian trattoria in which he had murdered the cockroach Pantangela and the two federal marshals last August. All ethnic art and decor, from Chinese to Italian to Polish to Irish, were, when boiled down to their essence, perfectly alike. The owner was a Chinese man in his 30s, who was introduced to Vince simply as Yuan. With bottles of Tsingtao provided by Yuan, Van Dyne and Vince went into the owner's basement office, where two computers stood on two desks, one out in the main work area, and the other shoved into a corner. The one in the corner was switched on, though nobody was working at it. This is my computer, Van Dyne said. No one here ever works with it. They never even touch it, except to open the phone line to put the modem in operation every morning and to close it at night. My computers at Hot Tips are linked to this one. You trust Yuan? I got him the loan that started this business. He owes me his good fortune. And it's pretty much a clean loan. Nothing that can be linked to me in any way, or to Don Tetragna. So Yuan remains an upstanding citizen who's of no interest to the cops. All he does for me in return is let me keep the computer here. Sitting in front of the terminal, Van Dyne began to use the keyboard. In 2 minutes, he had Travis Cornell's new name, Samuel Spencer Hyatt. And here, Van Dyne said as new data flickered up, this is the woman who was with him. Her real name was Nora Louise Devon of Santa Barbara. Now she's Nora Jean Ames. Okay, Vince said. Now wipe them off your records. What do you mean? Erase them. Take them out of the computer. They're not yours anymore. They're mine. Nobody else's. Just mine. A short while later, they were back at Hot Tips, which was a decadent place that revolted Vince. In the basement, Van Dyne gave the names Hyatt and Ames to the bearded boy wonders who seemed to live down there around the clock, like a couple of trolls. First, the trolls broke into the Department of Motor Vehicle Computers. They wanted to see whether, in the 3 months since acquiring new identities, Hyatt and Ames had settled down somewhere and filed a change of address with the state. Bingo, one of them said. An address appeared on the screen, and the bearded operator ordered a printout. Anson Van Dyne tore the paper off the printer and handed it to Vince. Travis Cornell and Nora Devon, now Hyatt and Ames, were living at a rural address on Pacific Coast Highway south of the town of Carmel. Part 5. On Wednesday, December 29th, Nora drove into Carmel alone for an appointment with Dr. Weingold. The sky was overcast, so dark that the white seagulls, swooping against the backdrop of clouds, were by contrast almost as bright as incandescent lights. The weather had been much the same since the day after Christmas, but the promised rain never came. Today, however, it came in torrents, just as she pulled the pickup into one of the spaces in the small parking lot behind Dr. Weingold's office. She was wearing a nylon jacket with a hood, just in case, and she pulled the hood over her head before dashing from the truck into the one-story brick building. Dr. Weingold gave her the usual thorough examination and pronounced her fit as a fiddle, which would have amused Einstein. I've never seen a woman at the 3-month mark in better shape, the doctor said. I want this to be a very healthy baby, a perfect baby. And so it shall be. The doctor believed that her name was Ames, and her husband's name was Hyatt, but he never once indicated disapproval of her marital status. The situation embarrassed Nora, but she supposed that the modern world, into which she had fluttered from the cocoon of the Devon house, was liberal-minded about these things. Dr. Weingold suggested, as he had done before, that she consider a test to determine the baby's sex, and as before, she declined. She wanted to be surprised. Besides, if they found out they were going to have a girl, Einstein would start campaigning for the name Minnie. After huddling with the doctor's receptionist to schedule the next appointment, Nora pulled the hood over her head again and went out into the driving rain. It was coming down hard, drizzling off a section of roof that had no gutters, sluicing across the sidewalk, forming deep puddles on the macadam of the parking lot. She sloshed through a miniature river on her way to the pickup, and in seconds her running shoes were saturated. As she reached the truck, she saw a man getting out of a red Honda parked beside her. She didn't notice much about him, just that he was a big guy in a small car, and that he was not dressed for the rain. He was wearing jeans and a blue pullover, and Nora thought, the poor man is going to get soaked to the skin. She opened the driver's door and started to get into the truck. The next thing she knew, the man in the blue sweater was coming in after her, shoving her across the seat and clambering behind the wheel. He said, if you yell, bitch, I'll blow your guts out. And she realized that he was jamming a revolver into her side. She almost yelled anyway, involuntarily, almost tried to keep on going across the front seat and out the door on the passenger's side. But something in his voice, brutal and dark, made her hesitate. He sounded as if he would shoot her in the back rather than let her escape. He slammed the driver's door, and now they were alone in the truck, beyond help, virtually concealed from the world by the rain that streamed down the windows and made the glass opaque. It didn't matter. The doctor's parking lot was deserted, and it could not be seen from the street. So even out of the truck, she would have had no one to whom to turn. He was a very big man, and muscular. But it was not his size that was most frightening. His broad face was placid, virtually expressionless. That serenity, completely unsuited to these circumstances, scared Nora. His eyes were worse, green eyes and cold. "Who are you?" she demanded, trying to conceal her fear, sure that visible terror would excite him. He seemed to be balanced on a thin line. "What do you want with me?" "I want the dog." She had thought, robber. She had thought, rapist. She had thought, psychopathic thrill killer. But she had not for a moment thought that he might be a government agent. Yet who else would be looking for Einstein? No one else even knew the dog existed. "What are you talking about?" she said. He pushed the muzzle of the revolver deeper into her side until it hurt. She thought of the baby growing within her. "All right, okay. Obviously you know about the dog, so there's no point playing games." "No point." He spoke so quietly that she could hardly hear him above the roar of the rain that drummed on the roof of the cab and snapped against the windshield. He reached over and pulled down the hood of her jacket, opened the zipper, and slid his hand down her breasts, over her belly. For a moment she was terrified that he was, after all, intent on rape. Instead, he said, "This Weingold is a gynecologist obstetrician." "So what's your problem? You have some damn social disease, or are you pregnant?" He almost spit out the words "social disease," as if merely pronouncing those syllables made him sick with disgust. "You're no government agent." She spoke entirely from instinct. "Ask you a question, bitch," he said in a voice barely louder than a whisper. He leaned close, digging the gun into her side again. The air in the truck was humid. The all-enveloping sound of rain combined with the stuffiness to create a claustrophobic atmosphere that was nearly intolerable. He said, "Which is it? You got herpes, syphilis, clap, some other crotch rot? Or are you pregnant?" Thinking that pregnancy might gain her a dispensation from the violence of which he seemed so capable, she said, "I'm going to have a baby. I'm 3 months pregnant." Something happened in his eyes. A shifting, like movement in a subtle kaleidoscopic pattern that was composed of bits of glass, all the same shade of green. Nora knew that admitting pregnancy was the worst thing she could have done, but she did not know why. She thought about the .38 pistol in the glove compartment. She could not possibly open the glove box, grab the gun, and shoot him before he pulled the trigger of the revolver. Still, she'd have to remain constantly on the lookout for an opportunity. For a laxness on his part that would give her a chance to go for her own weapon. Suddenly he was climbing on top of her, and again she thought he was going to rape her in broad daylight, in the veiling curtains of rain, but still daylight. Then she realized he was just changing places with her, urging her behind the wheel while he moved into the passenger's seat, keeping the muzzle of the revolver on her the whole time. "Drive," he said.
"Where?"
"Back to your place. But keep your mouth shut and drive." Now she was at the opposite side of the cab from the glove box. To get to it, she would have to reach in front of him. He would never be that lax. Determined to keep a rein on her galloping fear, she now found that she had to rein in despair as well. She started the truck, drove out of the parking lot, and turned right in the street. The windshield wipers thumped nearly as loud as her heart. She wasn't sure how much of the oppressive sound was made by the impacting rain, and how much of it was the roar of her own blood in her ears. Block by block, Nora searched for a cop, although she had no idea what she would do if she saw one. She never had to figure it out, because no cops were anywhere to be seen. Until they were out of Carmel and on the Pacific Coast Highway, the blustering wind not only drove rain against the windshield, but also flung bristling bits of cypress and pine needles from the huge old trees that sheltered the town streets. South along the coast, as they headed into steadily less populated areas, no trees overhung the road. But the wind off the ocean hit the pickup full force. Nora frequently felt it pulling at the wheel. And the rain, slashing straight at them from the sea, seemed to pummel the truck hard enough to leave dents in the sheet metal. After at least 5 minutes of silence, which seemed like an hour, she could no longer obey his order to keep her mouth shut.
"How did you find us?"
"I've been watching your place for more than a day," he said, in that cool, quiet voice that matched his placid face. "When you left this morning, I followed you, hoping you'd give me an opening."
"No, I mean, how did you know where we lived?"
He smiled. "Van Dyne.
That devil-crossing creep.
Special circumstances," he assured her. "The big man in San Francisco owed me a favor, so he put pressure on Van Dyne."
"Big man?"
"To Tragna."
"Who's he?"
"You don't know anything, do you?" he said. "Except how to make babies, huh? You know about that, huh?"
The hard, taunting note in his voice was not merely sexually suggestive. It was darker, stranger, and more terrifying than that. She was so frightened of the fierce tension that she sensed in him each time he approached the subject of sex that she did not dare reply to him. She turned on the headlights as they encountered thin fog. She kept her attention on the rain-washed highway, squinting through the smeary windshield. He said,
"You're very pretty. If I was going to stick it into anyone, I'd stick it into you."
Nora bit her lip.
"But even as pretty as you are," he said, "you're like all the others, I bet. If I stick it into you, then it'd rot and fall off because you're diseased like all the others, aren't you?" "Yeah, you are. Sex is death. I'm one of the few who seems to know it, even though proof is everywhere. Sex is death. But you're very pretty."
As she listened to him, her throat got tight. She was having difficulty drawing a deep breath. Suddenly, his taciturnity was gone. He talked fast, still soft voice and unnervingly calm, considering the crazy things he was saying, but very fast.
"I'm going to be bigger than Tetragna, more important. I've got scores of lives in me. I've absorbed energies from more than you'd believe, experienced the moment, felt the snap. It's my gift. When Tetragna's dead and gone, I'll be here. When everyone now alive is dead, I'll be here because I'm immortal."
She didn't know what to say. He had come out of nowhere, somehow knowing about Einstein, and he was a lunatic, and there seemed to be nothing she could do. She was as angry about the unfairness of it as she was afraid. They had made careful preparations for the outsider, and they had taken elaborate steps to elude the government. But how were they supposed to have prepared for this? It wasn't fair. Silent again, he stared at her intently for a minute or more, another eternity. She could feel his icy green gaze on her, as surely as she would have felt a cold, fondling hand.
"You don't know what I'm talking about, do you?" he said.
"No." Perhaps because he found her pretty, he chose to explain.
"I've only ever told one person before, and he made fun of me. His name was Danny Slovich, and we both worked for the Caramanza family in New York, biggest of the five mafia families. Little muscle work, once in a while killing people who needed killed."
Nora felt sick, because he was not merely crazy, and not merely a killer, but a crazy, professional killer. Unaware of her reaction, switching his gaze from the rain-swept road to her face, he continued. See, we were having dinner in this restaurant, Danny and me, washing down clams with Valpolicella. And I explained to him that I was destined to lead a long life because of my ability to acquire the vital energies of people I wasted. I told him, see, Danny, people are like batteries, walking batteries, filled with this mysterious energy we call life. When I off someone, his energy becomes my energy, and I get stronger. I'm a bull, Danny. I says, look at me. Am I a bull or what? And I gotta be a bull, because I have this gift of being able to take the energy from a guy. And you know what Danny says? What? She asked numbly. Well, Danny was a serious eater, so he kept his attention on his plate, facing his food, till he scarfs a few more clams. Then he looks up, his lips and chin dripping clam sauce, and he says, yeah, Vince? So where'd you learn this trick, huh? Where'd you learn how to absorb these life energies? I said, well, it's my gift. And he said, you mean like from God? So I had to think about that, and I said, who knows where from? It's my gift, like Mantle's hitting was a gift, like Sinatra's voice was a gift. And then he says, tell me this, suppose you waste a guy who's an electrician, after you absorb his energy, would you all of a sudden know how to rewire a house? I didn't realize he was putting me on. I thought it was a serious question, so I explained how I absorb life energy, not personality, not all the stuff the guy knows, just his energy. And then Danny says, so if you blew away a carnival geek, you wouldn't all of a sudden get the urge to bite the heads off chickens. Right then I knew Danny thought I was either drunk or nuts, so I ate clams and didn't say any more about my gift. And that's the last time I told anyone until I'm here telling you. He had called himself Vince, so now she knew his name. She did not know what good it would do her to know it. He had told his story without an indication that he was aware of the insane black humor in it. He was a deadly serious man. Unless Travis could deal with him, this guy was not going to let them live. So, Vince said, I couldn't risk Danny going around telling anyone what I told him, because he'd color it up, make it sound funny, and people would think I was nuts. The big bosses don't hire crazy hitmen. They want cool, logical, balanced guys who can do the work clean. Which is what I am, cool and balanced. But Danny would have had them thinking the other way. So that night I slit his throat. Took him to this deserted factory I knew, cut him into pieces, put him in a vat, and poured a lot of sulfuric acid over him. He was a favorite nephew of the Don's, so I couldn't take a chance of anyone finding a body that might be traced back to me. Now I got Danny's energy in me, along with a lot of others. The gun was in the glove box. Some small hope could be taken from the knowledge that the gun was in the glove box. While Nora was visiting Dr. Weingold, Travis whipped up and baked a double batch of cookies with peanut butter chips. Living alone, he'd learned to cook, but he had never taken pleasure in it. During the past few months, however, Nora had improved his culinary skills to such an extent that he enjoyed cooking, especially baking. Einstein, who usually hung around dutifully throughout a baking session in the anticipation of receiving a sweet morsel, deserted him before he had finished mixing the batter. The dog was agitated and moved around the house from window to window, staring out at the rain. After a while, Travis got edgy about the dog's behavior and asked if something was wrong. In the pantry, Einstein made his reply. I feel a little strange. Sick? Travis asked, worried about a relapse. The retriever was recovering well, but still recovering. His immune system was not in condition for a major new challenge. Not sick. Then what? You sense the outsider? No, not like before. But you sense something? Bad day. Maybe it's the rain. Maybe. Relieved but still edgy, Travis returned to his baking. The highway was silver with rain. The daytime fog grew slightly thicker as they drove south along the coast, forcing Nora to slow to 40 miles an hour, 30 in some places. Using the fog as an excuse, could she slow the truck enough to risk throwing open her door and leaping out? No, probably not. She would have to let their speed drop below 5 miles an hour in order not to hurt herself or her unborn child. And the fog simply was not dense enough to justify reducing speed that far. Besides, Vince kept the revolver pointed at her while he talked, and he would shoot her in the back as she turned to make her exit. The pickup's headlamps and those of the few oncoming cars were refracted by the mist. Halos of light and scintillant rainbows bounced off the shifting curtains of fog, briefly seen, then gone. She considered running the truck off the road, over the edge in one of the few places where she knew the embankment to be gentle and the drop endurable. But she was afraid she would misjudge where she was, and by mistake drive off the brink into a 200-foot emptiness, crashing with terrible force into the rocky coastline below. Even if she went over at the right point, a calculated and survivable crash might knock her unconscious or induce a miscarriage. And if possible, she wanted to get out of this with her life and the life of the child within her. Once Vince started talking to her, he could not stop. For years he had husbanded his great secrets, had hidden his dreams of power and immortality from the world. But his desire to speak of his supposed greatness evidently had never diminished after the fiasco with Danny Slovitz. It was as if he had stored up all the words he had wanted to say to people, had put them on reels and reels of mental recording tape, and now he was playing them back at high speed, spewing out all this craziness that made Nora sick with dread. He told her how he had learned of Einstein, the killing of the research scientists in charge of various programs under the Francis Project at Banodyne. He knew of the outsider, too, but was not afraid of it. He was, he said, on the brink of immortality, and gaining ownership of the dog was one of the final tasks he had to complete in order to achieve his destiny. He and the dog were destined to be together because each of them was unique in this world, one of a kind. Once Vince had achieved his destiny, he said, nothing could stop him, not even the outsider. Half the time, Nora didn't understand what he was saying. She supposed that if she did understand it, she would be as insane as he clearly was. But though she did not always grasp his meaning, she knew what he intended to do to her and to Travis once he had the retriever. At first she was afraid of speaking about her fate, as if putting it into words would somehow make it irrevocable. At last, however, when they were no more than 5 miles from the dirt lane that turned off the highway and led up to the bleached wood house, she said, "You won't let us go when you've got the dog, will you?" He stared at her, caressing her with his gaze. "What do you think, Nora?"
"I think you'll kill us."
"Of course."
She was surprised that his confirmation of her fears did not fill her with greater terror. His smug response only infuriated her, damping her fear while increasing her determination to spoil his neat plans. She knew, then, that she was a radically changed woman from the Nora of last May, who would have been reduced to uncontrollable shudders by this man's bold self-assurance. "I could run this truck right off the road, take my chances with an accident," she said.
"The moment you pulled on the wheel," he said, "I'd have to shoot you and then try to regain control."
"Maybe you couldn't. Maybe you'd die too."
"Me? Die? Maybe. But not in anything as minor as a traffic accident. No, no. I've got too many lives in me to go that easily. And I don't believe you'll try it anyway. In your heart of hearts, you believe that man of yours will pull a sharp one, save you and the dog and himself. You're wrong, of course, but you can't stop believing in him. He won't do anything because he'll be afraid of hurting you. I'll go in there with a gun in your belly, and that will paralyze him long enough for me to blow his head off. That's why I've only got the revolver. It's all I need. His caring for you, his fear of hurting you, will get him killed." Nora decided it was very important that she not let her fury show. She must try to look frightened, weak, utterly unsure of herself. If he underestimated her, he might slip up and give her some small advantage. Taking her eyes off the rainy highway for only a second, she glanced at him and saw that he was staring at her not with amusement or psychopathic rage, as she would have expected, and not with his usual bovine placidity either, but with something that looked very much like affection and maybe gratitude.
"I've dreamed for years of killing a pregnant woman," he said,
as if that was a goal no less worthwhile and commendable than wanting to build a business empire, or feed the hungry, or nurse the sick.
"I've never been in a situation where the risk of killing a pregnant woman was low enough to justify it. But in that isolated house of yours, once I've dealt with Cornell, the conditions will be ideal."
"Please, no," she said shakily, playing the weakling, though she didn't have to fake the nervous quiver in her voice.
Still speaking calmly, but with a trace more emotion than before, he said,
"There'll be your life energy, still young and rich, but in the instant you die, I'll also receive the energy of the child. And that'll be perfectly pure, unused, a life that's unsoiled by the many contaminants of this sick and degenerate world. You're my first pregnant woman, Nora, and I'll always remember you. Tears shimmered at the corners of her eyes, which was not just good acting, either. Although she did believe Travis would find some way to handle this man, she was afraid that in the turmoil, she or Einstein would die. And she did not know how Travis would be able to cope with his failure to save all of them.
"Don't despair, Nora," Vince said. "You and your baby will not entirely cease to exist. You'll both become a part of me, and in me, you'll live forever."
Travis took the first tray of cookies out of the oven and put them on a rack to cool. Einstein came sniffing around, and Travis said, "They're too hot yet." The dog returned to the living room to look out the front window at the rain. Just before Nora turned off the coast highway, Vince slid down on the seat, below the window level, out of sight. He kept the gun on her.
"I'll blow that baby right out of your belly if you make the slightest wrong move." She believed him.
Turning onto the dirt lane, which was muddy and slippery, Nora drove up the hill toward the house. The overhanging trees shielded the road from the worst of the rain, but collected the water on their branches and sent it to the ground in fatter droplets or rivulets. She saw Einstein at a front window, and she tried to come up with some signal that would mean trouble, that the dog would instantly understand. She couldn't think of anything. Looking up at her, Vince said,
"Don't go all the way to the barn. Stop right beside the house."
His plan was obvious. The corner of the house where the pantry and cellar stairs were located had no windows. Travis and Einstein would not be able to see the man getting out of the truck with her. Vince could hustle her around the corner, onto the back porch, and inside before Travis realized something was wrong. Maybe Einstein's canine senses would detect danger. Maybe, but Einstein had been so ill. Einstein padded into the kitchen, excited. Travis said, "Was that Nora's truck?"
"Yes."
The retriever went to the back door and did a dance of impatience, then stood still, cocked his head. Nora's stroke of luck came when she least expected it. When she parked alongside the house, engaged the handbrake, and switched off the engine, Vince grabbed her and dragged her across the seat, out of his side of the truck, because that was the side against the back end of the house and most difficult to see from windows at the front corner of the structure. Climbing from the pickup, pulling her by one hand, he was looking around to be sure Travis was not nearby. Distracted, he couldn't keep his revolver on Nora as closely as before. As she slid across the seat, past the glove box, she popped open the door and snatched up the .38 pistol. Vince must have heard or sensed something, because he swung toward her, but he was too late. She jammed the .38 into his belly, and before he could raise his gun and blow her head off, she squeezed the trigger 3 times. With a look of shock, he slammed back against the house, which was only 3 feet behind him. She was amazed by her own cold-bloodedness. Crazily, she thought that no one was so dangerous as a mother protecting her children, even if one child was unborn and the other was a dog. She fired once more, point-blank, at his chest. Vince went down hard, face first on the wet ground. She turned from him and ran. At the corner of the house, she almost collided with Travis, who vaulted over the porch railing and landed in a crouch in front of her, holding the Uzi carbine.
"I killed him," she said, hearing hysteria in her voice, fighting to control it. "I shot him 4 times. I killed him. My God!"
Travis rose from a crouch, bewildered. Nora threw her arms around him and put her head against his chest. As chilling rain beat upon them, she reveled in the living warmth of him.
"Who?"
Travis began. Behind Nora, Vince issued a shrill, breathless cry, and rolling onto his back, fired at them. The bullet struck Travis high in the shoulder and knocked him backward. If it had been 2 inches to the right, it would have hit Nora in the head. She was almost pulled off her feet when Travis fell because she was holding him. But she let go fast enough and went to the left, in front of the truck, out of the line of fire. She got only a quick look at Vince, who was holding his revolver in one hand and clutching his stomach with the other, trying to get off the ground. In that glimpse before she cowered down in front of the pickup, she had not seen any blood on the man. What was happening here? He could not possibly have survived 3 rounds in the stomach and 1 in the chest. Not unless he actually was immortal. Even as Nora scrambled for the cover of the truck, Travis had been getting off his back, sitting up in the mud. Blood was visible on him, spreading across his chest from his shoulder, soaking his shirt. He still had the Uzi in his right hand, which functioned in spite of the wound in that shoulder. As Vince pulled off a wild second shot, Travis opened fire with the Uzi. His position was no better than Vince's. The spray of bullets snapped into the house and ricocheted along the side of the truck, indiscriminate fire. He stopped shooting. Shit. He struggled onto his feet. Nora said, "Did you get him?" "He made it around to the front of the house," Travis said, and headed that way. Vince figured he was approaching immortality, almost there, if he had not already arrived. He was in need of, at most, only a few more lives, and his only concern was that he would be snuffed out when he was that close to his destiny. As a result, he took precautions, like the latest and most expensive model Kevlar bulletproof vest. He was wearing one under his sweater, which was what had stopped the 4 shots the bitch had tried to pump into him. The slugs had flattened against the vest, drawing no blood whatsoever, but Jesus, they had hurt. The impact had knocked him against the wall of the house and had driven the breath out of him. He felt as if he had lain on a giant anvil, while someone repeatedly pounded a blacksmith's hammer into his gut. Hunched over his pain, hobbling toward the front of the house, trying to get out of the way of the damn Uzi, he was sure he was going to be shot in the back. But somehow he made it to the corner, climbed the porch steps, and got out of Cornell's line of fire. Vince took some satisfaction in having wounded Cornell, though he knew it wasn't mortal. And having lost the element of surprise, he was in for a protracted battle. Hell, the woman looked to be almost as formidable as Cornell himself, a crazy Amazon. He could have sworn there was something of the timid mouse in the woman, that it was her nature to submit. Obviously, he misjudged her, and that spooked him. Vince Nasco was not accustomed to making such mistakes. Mistakes were for lesser men, not for the child of destiny. Scuttling across the front porch, certain that Cornell was coming fast behind him, Vince decided to go into the house instead of heading for the woods. They would expect him to run for the trees, take cover, and reconsider his strategy. Instead, he'd go straight into the house and find a position from which he could see both the front and rear doors. Maybe he'd take them by surprise yet. He was passing a large window, heading for the front door, when something exploded through the glass. Vince cried out in surprise and fired his revolver. But the shot went into the porch ceiling, and the dog, Jesus, that's what it was, the dog, hit him hard. His gun flew out of his hand. He was knocked backward. The dog clung to him, claws snagged in his clothes, teeth sunk in his shoulder. The porch railing disintegrated. They tumbled out into the front yard, into the rain. Screaming, Vince hammered at the dog with his big fists until it squealed and let go of him. Then it went for his throat, and he just knocked it off in time to prevent it tearing open his windpipe. His gut still throbbed, but he hitched and stumbled back to the porch, looking for his revolver, and found Cornell instead. Bleeding from his shoulder, Cornell was on the porch, looking down at Vince. Vince felt a great wild surge of confidence. He knew that he had been right all along, knew that he was invincible, immortal. Because he could look straight into the muzzle of the Uzi without fear, without the slightest fear. So he grinned up at Cornell.
"Look at me, look! I'm your worst nightmare."
Cornell said,
"Not even close,"
and opened fire. In the kitchen, Travis sat in a chair, with Einstein at his side, while Nora dressed his wound. As she worked, she told him what she knew about the man who had forced his way into the truck.
"He was a damn wild card," Travis said. "No way we could ever have known he was out there."
"I hope he's the only wild card."
Wincing as Nora poured alcohol and iodine into the bullet hole, wincing again as she bound the wound with gauze by passing it under his armpit, he said,
"Don't worry about making a great job of it. The bleeding's not that bad. No artery's been hit."
The bullet had gone through, leaving a hideous exit wound, and he was in considerable pain. But for a while yet, he would be able to function. He would have to seek medical attention later, maybe from Jim Keane, to avoid the questions that any other doctor would surely insist on having answered. For now, he was only concerned that the wound be bound tight enough to allow him to dispose of the dead man. Einstein was battered, too. Fortunately, he had not been cut when he smashed through the front window. He did not seem to have any broken bones, but he had taken several hard blows. Not in the best of shape to begin with, he looked bad, muddy and rain-soaked and in pain. He would need to see Jim Keane, too. Outside, rain was falling harder than ever, pounding on the roof, gurgling noisily through gutters and downspouts. It was slanting across the front porch and through the shattered window, but they did not have time to worry about water damage.
"Thank God for the rain," Travis said. "No one in the area will have heard the gunfire in this downpour."
Nora said, "Where will we dump the body?"
"I'm thinking." And it was hard to think clearly because the pain in his shoulder throbbed up and into his head.
She said, "We could bury him here in the woods."
"No, we'd always know he was there. We'd always worry about the body being dug up by wild animals, found by hikers.
Better, there are places along the coast highway where we could pull over, wait until there's no traffic, drag him out of the bed of the truck, and toss him over the side. If we pick a place where the sea comes in right to the base of the slope, it'll carry him out, move him away, before anyone notices him down there."
As Nora finished the bandage, Einstein abruptly got up, whined. He sniffed the air. He went back to the door, stood staring at it for a moment, then disappeared into the living room.
"I'm afraid he's hurt worse than he seems to be," Nora said, applying a final strip of adhesive tape.
"Maybe," Travis said, "but maybe not. He's just been acting peculiar all day, ever since he left this morning. He told me it smelled like a bad day."
"He was right," she said.
Einstein returned from the living room at a run and went straight to the pantry, switching on the lights and pumping the pedals that released lettered tiles.
"Maybe he has an idea about disposing of the body," Nora said.
As Nora gathered up the leftover iodine, alcohol, gauze, and tape, Travis painfully pulled on his shirt and went to the pantry to see what Einstein had to say.
"The outsider is here."
Travis slammed a new magazine into the butt of the Uzi carbine, put an extra one in pocket, and gave Nora one of the Uzi pistols that was kept in the pantry. Judging by Einstein's sense of urgency, they had no time to go through the house, closing and bolting shutters. The clever scheme to gas the outsider in the barn had been built upon the certainty that it would approach at night and reconnoiter. Now that it had come in daylight, and had reconnoitered while they were distracted by Vince, that plan was useless. They stood in the kitchen, listening, but nothing could be heard above the relentless roar of the rain. Einstein was not able to give them a more precise fix on their adversary's location. His sixth sense was still not working up to par. They were just lucky that he had sensed the beast at all. His morning-long anxiety had evidently not been related to any presentiment about the man who had come home with Nora, but had been, even without his knowledge, caused by the approach of the outsider.
"Upstairs," Travis said. "Let's go."
Down here, the creature could enter by doors or windows, but on the second floor, they would at least have only windows to worry about. And maybe they could get shutters closed over some of those. Nora climbed the stairs with Einstein. Travis brought up the rear, moving backward, keeping the Uzi aimed down at the first floor. The ascent made him dizzy. He was acutely aware that the pain and weakness in his injured shoulder was slowly spreading outward through his entire body, like an ink stain through a blotter. On the second floor, at the head of the stairs, he said, "If we hear it come in, we can back off. Wait until it starts to climb toward us, then step forward and catch it by surprise. Blow it away." She nodded. They had to be silent now. Give it a chance to creep into the downstairs. Give it time to decide they were on the second floor. Let it gain confidence. Let it approach the stairs with a sense of security. A strobe flash of lightning, the first of the storm, pulsed at the window at the end of the hall, and thunder cracked. The sky seemed to have been shattered by the blast, and all the rain stored in the heavens collapsed upon the earth in one tremendous fall.
At the end of the hallway, one of Nora's canvases flew out of her studio and crashed against the wall. Nora cried out in surprise, and for an instant, all three of them stared stupidly at the painting lying on the hall floor, half thinking that its poltergeist-like flight had been related to the great crash of thunder and the lightning. A second painting sailed out of her studio, hit the wall, and Travis saw the canvas was shredded. The outsider was already in the house. They were at one end of the short hall. The master bedroom and future nursery were on the left, the bathroom and Nora's studio on the right. The thing was just two doors away, in Nora's studio, demolishing her paintings. Another canvas flew into the hallway. Rain-soaked, muddied, battered, still somewhat weak from his battle with distemper, Einstein nevertheless barked viciously, trying to warn off the outsider. Holding the Uzi, Travis moved one step down the hall. Nora grabbed his arm.
Let's not. Let's get out.
No, we've got to face it.
On our terms,
she said. These are the best terms we're going to get. Two more paintings flew out of the studio and clattered down on top of the growing pile of wrecked canvases. Einstein was no longer barking, but growling deep in his throat. Together they moved along the hall, toward the open door of Nora's studio. Travis's experience and training told him they ought to split up, spread out, instead of grouping into a single target. But this was not Delta Force, and their enemy was not a mere terrorist. If they spread out, they would lose some of the courage they needed to face the thing. Their very closeness gave them strength. They were halfway to the studio door when the outsider shrieked. It was an icy sound that stabbed right through Travis and quick froze his bone marrow. He and Nora halted, but Einstein took two more steps before stopping. The dog was shuddering violently. Travis realized he too was shaking. The tremors aggravated the pain in his shoulder. Breaking fear's hold, he rushed to the open door, treading on ruined canvases, spraying bullets into the studio. The weapon's recoil, though minimal, was like a chisel chipping into his wound. He hit nothing, heard nothing scream, saw no sign of the enemy. The floor in there was littered with a dozen mangled paintings and glass from the broken window by which the thing had entered after climbing onto the front porch roof. Waiting, Travis stood with his legs spread wide, the gun in both hands, blinking sweat out of his eyes, trying to ignore the seething pain in his right shoulder. Waiting. The outsider must be to the left of the door, or behind it on the right, crouched, ready to spring. If he gave it time, maybe it would grow tired of waiting, and would rush him, and he could cut it down in the doorway. No, it's as smart as Einstein, he told himself. Would Einstein be so dumb as to rush me through a narrow doorway? No. No, it'll do something more intelligent, unexpected. The sky exploded with thunder so powerful it vibrated the windows and shook the house. Chain lightning sizzled through the day. Come on, you bastard, show yourself. He glanced at Nora and Einstein, who stood a few steps away from him, with the master bedroom on one side of them and the bathroom on the other side, the stairs behind them. He looked again through the doorway, at the window glass among the debris on the floor. Suddenly he was certain that the outsider was no longer in the studio, that it had gone out through the window, onto the roof of the front porch, and that it was coming at them from another part of the house, through another door, perhaps out of one of the bedrooms, or from the bathroom, or maybe it would explode at them, shrieking from the top of the steps. He motioned Nora forward to his side. Cover me. Before she could object, he went through the doorway, into the studio, moving in a crouch. He nearly fell in the rubble, but stayed on his feet and spun around, ready to open fire if the thing was looming over him. It was gone. The closet door was open. Nothing in there. He went to the broken window and cautiously looked out onto the roof of the rain-washed porch. Nothing. Wind keened over the dangerously sharp shards of glass still bristling from the window frame. He started back toward the upstairs hall. He could see Nora out there, looking in at him, scared, but gamely clutching her Uzi. Behind her, the door to the future nursery opened, and it was there. yellow eyes aglow. Its monstrous jaws cracked wide, full of teeth far sharper than the wicked glass shards in the window frame. She was aware of it, started to turn, but it struck at her before she had a chance to fire. It tore the Uzi out of her hands. It had no chance to gut her with its razor-edged, 6-inch claws, because even as the beast was tearing the pistol out of her hands, Einstein charged it, snarling. With cat-like quickness, the outsider shifted its attention from Nora to the dog. It whipped around on him, lashed out as if its long arms were constructed with more than one elbow joint. It snatched Einstein up in both horrendous hands. Crossing the studio to the hall door, Travis had no clear shot at the outsider, because Nora was between him and that hateful thing. As Travis reached the doorway, he cried out for her to fall down, to give him a line of fire. And she did, immediately, but too late. The outsider scooped Einstein into the nursery and slammed the door, as if it were an evil nightmare-spawned jack-in-the-box that had popped out and popped back in with its prey, all in the blink of an eye. Einstein squealed, and Nora rushed the nursery door. "No!" Travis shouted, pulling her aside. He aimed the automatic carbine at the closed door and emptied the rest of the magazine into it, punching at least 30 holes in the wood, crying out through clenched teeth as pain flared through his shoulder. There was some risk of hitting Einstein, but the retriever would be in worse danger if Travis did not open fire. When the gun stopped spitting bullets, he ripped out the empty magazine, took a full magazine from his pocket, and slammed that into the gun. Then he kicked open the ruined door and went into the nursery. The window stood open, curtains blowing in the wind. The outsider was gone. Einstein was on the floor, against one wall, motionless, covered with blood. Nora made a wrenching sound of grief when she saw the retriever. At the window, Travis spotted slashes of blood leading across the porch roof. Rain was swiftly washing the gore away. Movement caught his eye, and he looked toward the barn, where the outsider disappeared through the big door. Crouching over the dog, Nora said, "Oh my God, Travis, my God! After all he's come through, and now he has to die like this!" "I'm going after the son of a bitching bastard," Travis said ferociously. "It's in the barn." She moved toward the door, too, and he said, "No, call Jim Keane, and then stay with Einstein. Stay with Einstein."
"But you're the one who needs me. You can't go after it alone."
"Einstein needs you."
"Einstein is dead," she said through tears.
"Don't say that," he screamed at her. He was aware that he was irrational, as if he believed Einstein would not really be dead until they said he was dead. But he could not control himself. "Don't say he's dead. Stay here with him, damn it. I've already hurt that fucking fugitive from a nightmare. Hurt it bad, I think. It's bleeding, and I can finish it off myself. Call Jim Keane. Stay with Einstein."
He was also afraid that in all of this activity, she was going to induce a miscarriage, if she had not already done so. Then they would have lost not only Einstein, but the baby. He left the room at a run. "You're in no condition to go into that barn," he told himself. "You've got to cool down first." Telling Nora to call a vet for a dead dog, telling her to stay with it when in fact you could have used her at your side. No good. Letting rage and a thirst for vengeance get the best of you. No good. But he could not stop. All of his life he had lost people he loved, and except in Delta Force, he'd never had anyone to strike back at, because you can't take vengeance on fate. Even in Delta, the enemy was so faceless. The lumpish mass of maniacs and fanatics who are international terrorism, that vengeance provided little satisfaction. But here was an enemy of unparalleled evil, an enemy worthy of the name, and he would make it pay for what it had done to Einstein. He raced down the hallway, descended the stairs two and three at a time, was hit by a wave of dizziness and nausea, and nearly fell. He grabbed at the banister to steady himself. He leaned on the wrong arm, and hot pain flared in his wounded shoulder. Letting go of the railing, he lost his balance and tumbled down the last flight, hitting the bottom hard. He was in worse shape than he had thought. Clutching the Uzi, he got to his feet and staggered to the back door, onto the porch, down the steps, into the yard. The cold rain cleared his fuzzy head, and he stood for a moment on the lawn, letting the storm wash some of the dizziness out of him.
An image of Einstein's broken, bloody body flashed through his mind. He thought of the amusing messages that would never be formed on the pantry floor. And he thought of Christmases to come without Einstein padding around in his sandwich.